All right. Well, let's begin. I'm going to read, first of all, from Psalm 139. I'll come back to this towards the end, but just to begin here, the first half of that psalm says, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in, behind and before, and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me at night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Well, here David obviously is saying many things, but amongst those many things is the fact that he speaks here as a covenant child, as a member of the covenant, who says that even before he was in existence, the Lord already knew him, and the Lord was there with him in his mother's womb, knitting him, forming him together, and so forth. And so one of the implications of that is not merely that we see here sort of going backwards from our understanding of our children to be holy in the eyes of God, and so they're holy in the womb. But what does that mean then for little ones who are in the womb but then die before they are brought into the world by birth? And so I want to think today about ministering after miscarriages, a difficult topic, but one that's important. Unless things have changed here at the seminary, you probably will never hear anything about that at the seminary. The seminary can't do everything, so I guess it falls to us to try to get to some of the details, some of the deep, dark secrets that you don't learn about the ministry, that you one day get a phone call and you have to deal with it. So ministering after miscarriages is an important topic. It's a very challenging topic. It's probably, for me as a minister of the gospel, 10-plus years, it's probably been the most difficult topic, issue, pastoral circumstance to deal with. As I said before, I wasn't prepared for that. And so how do you do what you're supposed to do? What do you say? How do you say it? When do you say it? And so forth. So hopefully I can impart some of my practical experience to you to prepare you for how to deal with what it really is, a terrible providence of God to the hearts and lives of our brothers and sisters. We look at them, you'll see their faces, and it's really just tears your heart out to see that. So we not only say here with David, Psalm 139, these wonderful things here about the nature of covenant children and the knowledge that God has of them, of us, even in the womb. So not merely our little children, but even at the moment of conception, there is the Lord with them. So we say that with the psalmist, and we see some of that played out in how our canons of Dort describe the nature of children who die in infancy. So it's one thing for us to confess the comfort that the canons of Dort, Head 1, Article 17, describe, which we'll look at in just a moment. But it's quite another to actually be able to minister that comfort. So it's one thing that it's easy to say it, and people no doubt have read this. Maybe you will preach on it, you'll teach on it at some point. But when you actually have to go through that, it's a whole other struggle. So I just want to give a couple of brief practical points on how to minister after miscarriages. Three main ideas. The first one, and I hope these are obvious, and so that's the beauty of hopefully what I say is that it's obvious, and it's really not such a hurdle and such a difficult thing to do, at least outwardly. But first of all, to be prepared. So how do I minister as a pastor after a member of a church, or maybe even a friend of a member or somebody in the circle of our church has a miscarriage? The first very obvious point is to be prepared for that. So the first reason why you need to be prepared for that is that miscarriage is a very prominent experience of families, of women. It's the most common type of pregnancy loss. Did some research, and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, there's various estimates, but the range is somewhere between 10 and 25% of what are called clinically recognized pregnancies end in miscarriage. So 10 to 25%. That's not including the vast amounts of what are called chemical abortions, meaning that there's sperm and egg come together, but that does not attach to the uterus wall, and so it's considered a chemical pregnancy, a chemical abortion. There's life, as we would see it, but it's never really, sort of technically speaking, a pregnancy. So in that case, many women have had miscarriages without even knowing it. And so, and we'll see why that's such a real burdensome question in just a moment. So be prepared in terms of just realizing that as a pastor, you will have women in your congregation that have already had miscarriages, and there will be women who will have miscarriages, and it's not only going to be hard for those that are having it, but it brings back a lot of difficult struggle in the hearts and minds of the women in the church that have had the past. So it just brings up the past, and it's very difficult. Secondly, be prepared because miscarriages bring a whole host of questions. So you've got to be ready with very gospel-centered, simple words of comfort. I often refer to 1 Peter 3:15 in the context of our congregation being exhorted to be salt and light, to be witnesses. Peter says there that we are always to be prepared to make a defense, to make an apology to anyone who would ask us the reason for the hope that lies within us with gentleness and self-control. And so that's certainly apropos for the Christian. But those words are also important for us as pastors and as well as, Lord willing, future ministers, that we have to be prepared not merely to give defense and answers to those outside the church for our hope, but if we really believe that there's hope for these little ones, we have to give an answer for that. And to even to show that in a very loving way. There are a whole host of theological questions in that bibliography that I gave you. There's a wonderful little article. It's online as a PDF by Dan Doriani. He's a pastor. He's also a teacher at Covenant Seminary in St. Louis. He experienced a miscarriage, and so he wrote this wonderful little article. It doesn't give a lot of theological reasons for why we say what we say, but it gives a lot of practical experience as well as advice. He summarizes some of the theological questions, and these are honestly questions that I've heard, maybe not exactly phrased this way, but I've heard these as well. He says this in that article: in the quieter moments of the next 2 days after his wife had had a miscarriage, very different questions troubled me. Intellectual questions contradicting my convictions about the unborn and my feelings about our child. I wondered, is heaven populated with the unborn? Are all the unborn there? If so, are the Soviets, who are said to perform 3 abortions for every live birth, filling heaven with their monstrous practice? Are only the progeny of believers there? Even so, there must be billions, since miscarriage is so common. How does that affect their eternity? Or perhaps, the Bible says a little about these matters, perhaps the Orthodox doctrine is wrong. Perhaps my child was not yet a person, not yet my child. It's hard to imagine the life of a former fetus in heaven. So people will ask you very difficult theological questions maybe in a different context, they might seem like the angels on Pinhead's questions, but they're real questions that people are honestly trying to wrestle with. He goes on to list some practical questions. So not only do you need to be prepared with the Word to comfort people from the Word of God, but also in a very practical way, Doriani lists other questions that he had, which again are very relevant things that I've heard, whether this exact way or not, but yet the same sentiment. He says this, "More painfully, I wondered, how did my son, so small, so undeveloped, die? Like a higher animal, feeling, but without self-consciousness. Like a worm, all but insensitive. Like a man, carried off by angels, rejoicing." And these are all questions he's asking. "Our defense of the unborn, our speeches and sermons and silent stream videos force these questions. If abortion is murder, miscarriage is a death in the family. But it is a strange kind of death. Where is the funeral? The gathering of family?" And that's usually a question people ask. Well, what do we do? Do we have some kind of a funeral or some kind of a service? Whether there's actually something to bury or not? He says, there were other questions. Why was I, speaking of him as a husband, why was I in more pain than my wife? So these are not just questions that the wife who's actually experienced will have, but even the husband. Why did one daughter, he had two daughters, why did one daughter act as if nothing had happened? And most troubling, why did I feel polluted, almost guilty? The next night I went jogging, alone in the darkness with God, answers came. I began to understand my wife's subdued response. She felt something was amiss and never attached herself to one she would never hold. So we have to be prepared to face this pastoral issue like a whole other enormous litany of problems that you need to face, but this one, because it's so prominent, and it's very important and very deep and very emotional. So besides being prepared, the second point following on that is you have to be involved. So I hope that goes without saying, that if you are prepared to say something, that means that you're going to be prepared to be involved in the life of the family, maybe a single woman after a miscarriage. So as Doriani says there, that wonderful line, if abortion is murder, miscarriage is the death in the family. As a pastor, I found that, and I would exhort you to think in the same way, that we need to treat miscarriage as in the same way as we would treat any other death in our congregation or the family members of a member of the congregation, extended family and so forth. Why would I treat the death of a member's father who lives in Grand Rapids any different than the death of a little one that's in the congregation? So we need to treat miscarriage as a normal, but as a death of a family member that is in our congregation. So what does that mean? As pastors, we are expected, in some circles expected, in some circles not understood, but in churches like mine, we have to actually explain that we do this, but to go actually visit. When somebody in the congregation dies, to visit the family of the loved one who's died. And when there's a miscarriage, when you find out about it, go visit. So being involved is the actual visiting. And being there, and you can read the Doriani the article. It's only, I think, 4 or 5 pages. But one of the things he says in there that's so striking is that what mattered most to him, he said, in his family, was not all the phone calls and all the people coming up to them at church and so forth, but what mattered most was people sending cards, because it did express their affection for them, their love for them, their sorrow, but it also left them their own distance and their own time to grieve. But he said, you know, just the pastor and just being there. So honestly, you know, when somebody dies, there are just no great way of saying things. So just being there with the family who's grieving means a lot to them. I would also say to be involved means to listen. You're not going there just to give a sermon. It's not a sermon. You're not there to give a Bible study. It's not a Bible study. You're not there to give a catechism lesson and so forth. But go and listen. Ask questions. Ask how she's feeling. Ask how, you know, she's doing. ask her to express how she's feeling and why, and ask if she has questions and so forth. Don't just go there with a sort of pre-canned speech. It never works that way anyway, but go there to listen. I was once told, just to share a story, I was once told when I was in seminary, I was an intern at a little church in Northwest Iowa, and there was a retired pastor in the area that was there. I think some of you may have heard the story before, but I was there for the whole summer exhorting, and he was there on a certain Sunday service. And after the service, he came up to me and introduced himself and so forth, and then he kind of got into his agenda with me, which was that I was going around visiting too many people, and I was making the other pastors in the area look bad. And I was, I was kind of shocked at that. If you know my story or not, but, I came to seminary with the intention of getting in here and getting out, getting a PhD in teaching, never, ever being a preacher, but God had other plans for me. So I was only there. I was there for one reason. Well, two reasons. Didn't need somebody. But secondly, I had no clue how to preach a sermon, how to write a sermon, what to do. And really, I was, you think I talk fast now, you should have heard me then. I had no desire to stand in front of people and speak. And so I did it out of my own of questioning of, am I actually called to do this? And if I really am terrible at it, it'll be so obvious that I need to get out of this MDiv idea and go get a PhD. But if I have any abilities, it'll be evident to others and to me. So part of my doing that was not only to preach, but to visit as many people as possible, to do everything I could that a pastor would normally do, to figure out, do I have what it takes to be a pastor. So I visited a lot of people in the hospital and so forth, and people who shut in, and families and this and that. And so I got a reputation, a bad one, at visiting too many people and making others look bad. So this pastor gave me his unsolicited advice, which was, when I go visit, and he implied that when I go visit too, he said, when I go visit, it's no more than half an hour. Get in there and get out, is what he said. Get in there and get out. Honestly, I've never been on a family visit less than like an hour, hour and a half. I've never gone to a premarital counseling session or a counseling session or a time when people are grieving where it's been less than several hours. So maybe I'm the exception to the rule, but just being there and listening usually means more than the things you actually say to people. So just to exhort you to be there in their midst, if they would like you to be there, just to offer yourself to listen to them. Obviously, to be involved means that you need to read the Word with them. You are a minister of the gospel. There's a couple of passages that I'll suggest in a moment, but to be there to read the Word, and obviously to pray. I mean, those are the two main sort of substantive things, the tools at our disposal, the Word and prayer. And so we need to go there. At some point, in our being there, that you transition it into, can I take some time to read with you the Word and just say a few things about it and to pray. I'm sure Steve would probably say the same thing. There's never really like a good moment. it's just at some point you gotta just kind of interject yourself, and do that. So.
And that's where listening pays off.
Yeah.
Because if you're listening, no matter what you came prepared with, you usually end up hearing what you need to address.
Yeah. Yeah, honestly, if I'm going and I'm reading Psalm 139, I got like two main ideas I'm going to communicate, and I'm going to pray, and I get my prayer memorized, and I'm so nervous. And the questions that you get, honestly, I feel like sometimes before I even get to the reading and the praying, everything that this passage says, I've already said it because the person's asked all the questions. Or it's been like questions that I've never thought about that have taken on such, kind of a tangent. But it's good because people need to ask and to be able to express themselves. And so a lot of times it's very short. I don't really go into it with sort of a pre-planned approach. Just I kind of know at some point I'm going to read a passage, I'm going to pray. The rest of it kind of let it steer itself. So just before we move on to the third final point, what time do we have here? One thing, at least in our church, and maybe it's the same in churches that you are in or have come from, or maybe at some point you will be in. But one of the things that I do to be involved with people is that I offer to, on their behalf, to contact our deacons. We have a thing we call Mercy Meals in our church, where anytime anybody has any need for meals, whether they've had a baby, they've had a death, whether they're sick, they're in the hospital, anything, and they or their family need meals, to take burden off them and pressure off them, to have to prepare and do all this stuff and clean up and so forth. Our deacons head that up, and we have a group of people in the church that have volunteered to do that. And so I offer myself to do that, so that they don't have to do it, because they don't have to call a deacon up and say, like, hey, we had a miscarriage, can you provide food? Like, who wants to do that? Nobody. So I offer to do it for them, to provide the meals. And then I offer to let the congregation know, would you like me to email the church? I'll put it in the bulletin if you want. I'll mention it on Sunday. Do you mind if I pray? It's difficult, just to realize it's difficult, those situations. You don't want to pray weeks on end for somebody who's lost, had a miscarriage, or even a death, because at some point, you don't want to drag on the grief forever, at least publicly. You want to mention it, you want to pray about it, let the church do its job to take care of the members, one with another. Another pastor, merely just to mention it by an email, we have a list, whether in the bulletin or you pray it in public, at least the church knows in a public way that this matters to us, and it's important for us to rally around the family that's grieving. So, any comments or questions before I move on? Norm?
Is there a place for silence about it, in the sense of not making it known, like just, they say it was early in the term. We want you to know, but we don't, like, if it was a death of a loved one, we might, it is a death of a loved one, so we review it in that paradigm, we would then say, as brothers and sisters, we all want to be able to share our suffering. Have you had people that really want this just kept? I mean, the traditional method of approaching miscarriages don't talk about it.
Yeah.
How do we sort of counsel against that for the sake of grieving together?
Yeah. I've had people that have wanted me to email the church, to pray in public, and I've had people that have said they didn't. Whether it was such a traumatic thing that they didn't want to be dragged out. Or it was just, it was very early. Like he says, his wife never felt attached to the pregnancy, and so, not that it didn't matter to the wife, if the feelings are, you can't describe. I mean, I'm a man, so how would I ever know this? I can't describe what it must be like. And so, in some situations, it seems as if, there wasn't really emotional attachment, and so, why make more out of it than needs to be? It's a death, it's hard. But we're going to deal with it and move on. We appreciate you being here and so forth. So it's kind of left at that. So that's why I offer to do this. I don't say, hey, I'm going to put it in the bulletin, big, It's just you offer to announce and let the person make the decision. So any other questions or comments? Okay. So again, to be prepared for this, be involved when it happens. Maybe just to take a step back, in our church, obviously non-traditional church, people in our congregation, they come to our church with no expectation of ever knowing the pastor by name, or him ever knowing their name, or so forth. That's just the case, what we have in our church. And the people that come to our church are either have no church background, or they come from everything other than Reformed, and it's just they know their home group leader. They don't know the pastor. So in our church, it does take a little more intentional explanation to people that, I usually do a sort of membership process that, as a member of the church, here's what your obligations are, but then here are also the privileges. And there are a lot of unwritten privileges in a church. Obviously the privileges of being a member and taking the Lord's Supper and, being there for church and catechism but what about family visiting? Well, who's heard of that in our culture around here? Nobody. So family visit. What happens if you get sick and you go in the hospital, or if you have a death in the family and so forth? Well, in our church, what I explain is that the pastor and even elders and even deacons We want to come visit you. That's part of what we want to do. And especially as a pastor, we see it as a part of our job. So in my church, I had to explain that to people because I'll find out, oh yeah, such and such was in the hospital. Like recently, somebody was in the hospital. And I found out somebody else is going for a procedure on Friday, which I had no idea. So, you know, it is awkward to kind of like interject yourself into that, but it's like, I do it out of concern. It's like, hey, just so you know, I'm available to you. And if you want me to come visit you before you go in the hospital or after or while, I am more than willing to do that whenever you want me to. So that sometimes needs to be said, and maybe it's assumed in other places, you know, but I don't know. I mean,
and we're a traditional church, and a lot of times we'll find out stuff until the day of, after, because they don't want anybody talking about it or being concerned. So I mean,
yeah,
you're often not the first to know, even if you've asked to be.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully, I have a really open church, and people really care about each other, and yeah, there are times where people don't want everyone to know about something, but that's very rare. For the most part, people want, you know, we have an elder that his wife has breast cancer now, and so we announced that by email, and then on Sunday, it was great to see, because, I mean, almost everyone in the church was, like, going to see her, and she felt like really overwhelmed by it. She appreciated it. I mean, she understands, like, people really care, but she didn't know that people actually care about me in this church. I mean, she knows that, like, in theory, but she never felt it, you know. So she was like, yeah, it was really overwhelming, and, you know, but I know why people are doing that, because they really care about me, which I didn't know. She's, you know, so it's kind of like, you know, she's kind of weighing it in her head, like, okay, it is a positive, but it's taking her a little bit of time to kind of get there, but. Anywho, and finally, the third final point here, which again is an assumed point, but be a minister. So you're there to be a minister. So, you know, you're there to listen, you're there to ask questions, you're there just to be there, you know, but you're also there to be a pastor and to be a minister. So what do you do as a minister? Let me just, three things. I mentioned scripture, word, and prayer, but let me just, before that, also say, I would really encourage you to read the Canons of Dort 117 with families in this situation. So Canons of Dort 117, which says, since we are to judge of the will of God from His Word, which testifies that the children of believers are holy, not by nature, but in virtue of the covenant of grace, in which they together with the parents are comprehended, godly parents ought not to doubt the election and salvation of their children, whom it pleases God to call out of this life, in their infancy. Now, the context, of course, is a very high infant mortality rate. It's not per se dealing with miscarriage. But if it's true that children in infancy who are born, who die, in that case, in the Netherlands, I think the Netherlands or in England, it's probably about the same, but there's like a 30 to 40% infant mortality rate at the time of the Canons of Dort. And so, you know, vast numbers of people in your congregation knew what it was to have a child born and then die. John Owen had 11 children, 10 of them died. So it was sort of a normal thing. So, you know, read this. I would say, like I said, with Psalm 139 and this, you know, they're not dealing with miscarriage per se, but they're speaking to that issue of who are our children and what does God say about our children? And even before they're born, as the psalm says. Now, the issue here, just to say a word about this, because I put there on the bibliography for you, not only a couple of things to read about miscarriage, which are good, but also some resources on understanding Canons 117. And I'll admit that I'm biased on, there's sort of a debate on how far we take it, and I'm biased, but I'll admit that from the outset. You won't see Herman Hoeksema on there because I'm biased. So there's a debate in Reformed circles, and there has been for quite a while, on Canons 117. Does it say only that sort of the Hoeksema side of it would say it's not saying that all children of believers who die in the sea are in heaven? It's not saying that. It's merely saying that subjectively we shouldn't feel like they're going, that they're not in heaven. The other side is the list I gave you of resources there. It says, no, this article in the Kansdorp is saying that our children are in heaven. And it's not merely that we should feel that way, but that because of the nature of God's promises, we have no reason to doubt that. Which means that we should have actually a strong belief and a strong comfort and encouragement. So, on the one hand, there are those who would say, well, it's only saying that you ought not to doubt, which is less than saying have a positive confidence. The other side says, no, that's a way of speaking that says, actually, no, you should have a strong confidence to say that you ought not to doubt because of all the things that are said there. So, the Bavinck just gives a few things here and there. He gives some, he cites some other Reformed Orthodox preachers and authors on the issue. Just to look at that list here for a second here. The Bavinck, John Calvin has a letter he wrote to a woman who lost a child and expresses his confidence that that little one was in heaven. Skipping on to John Owen, same thing. John Owen has a letter to a woman, same thing, where he expresses the same belief. The little book by Lee Gaddis, he's a Church of England preacher, he's also a PhD student right now. He wrote a little book on John Owen's view of infant baptism and infant salvation, which is really helpful to at least get a sense of what Owen said. Dr. Godfrey, I'm sure if you're nice, would give you out of his vault his unpublished essay. So you may not know, but he's got a whole bunch of stuff that's never published that are sitting in huge black binders on a shelf that are filled with lots of great stuff. So if you go there and play nice, maybe he'll give you that. Nick Hutches, who was a KNRC professor in their seminary, I think he's retired now, wrote a couple of little articles on the same issue. And then Cornelis Venema, a couple of years ago in the Mid-American Journal, wrote a very lengthy article on the history behind the canons and so forth. So those are the things that I would encourage you to read on that issue to help you understand, you know, why we read this and why it's there and what it means and what it says for our little ones. So I would say encourage you to read that and do that also, secondly, by reading the Word. Psalm 139, here's a great example of the confidence that David had about himself before he was even born and the knowledge that God had of him, a positive knowledge. He knew him there in the womb. There is a sort of a larger debate in the history of Christian thought on, you know, what is the status of children who die, not merely of believers, but all children. And so, you know, throughout the history of the church have been a whole host of positions, all the way from saying that all children who die before they, you know, reject or accept the gospel, all children go to heaven. There's, of course, those that would say it a little more precisely, like the Westminster Confession, that elect infants go to heaven. Nobody doubts that. Elect infants go to heaven. And then there are obviously those that would say, well, some infants go to heaven, some go to hell, because that's the nature of mercy and wrath. And Psalm 139 speaks of this great confidence. So some would say that this passage teaches as well that all children, in that sense, like David describes, I would say, well, at minimum, it says here, speaking of David as a member of the covenant, what the canons say. Also, another passage, 2 Samuel 12, where David expresses his deep agony for his son's sickness, ultimately his death, which, of course, the irony of the passage is he's agonized while he's sick. He's joyful while after he dies. And, you know, there's a lot sort of implied there, but he's joyful after, because he gets, you know, he's in the dust and so forth. He's not eating at all. And then the son dies. He gets up and says, he eats. And his servants are just absolutely dumbfounded. You know, what are you doing? While he was alive, you were, you know, morbid. And while he's dead, you're happy. Because he says he would see him again. So his son wouldn't come to him, but he would go to him, his son. He would see him in heaven. So, and why can he say that? Because his son belonged to covenant. And so this is a sort of classic passage in the Reformed tradition that explains our view of the covenant and our children, their position in it. So Psalm 139, 2 Samuel 12, those are just the two passages that I traditionally read when I go with the family. Normally Psalm 139, just Psalms usually read better in that situation. And then finally to pray. And honestly, you know, what do you pray? I mean, how do you know what to say? How do you, you know, say it that you don't offend them or crush them? It's hard. Let's just be honest. So I just encourage you to avail yourselves of a couple of written prayers that can help you. Whether you actually read them with the family, you know, that's up to you. But they, at minimum, can give you a pattern of what to pray and how to pray. In the back of the hymnal, the Psalter hymnal, there are those prayers that are never used, but they're really wonderful. There's a prayer for the sick and spiritually distressed. There's two prayers, actually, at the back of the hymnal. And then the revised liturgical forms, there's a revision of that prayer into it's one prayer. It was in the agenda for synod. It's online, but you have to, the USC website, you have to like log in. I mean, still kind of unwieldy to me, but if you want that, just send me an email. I can email you all the revised forms and prayers. I have them all as a booklet that I use and that we've sent out to some churches that have asked for it. So, you know, to see how other people have prayed in times of great distress is helpful to us, at least to help you, guide you. But, you know, I would encourage you also, you know, if you're just absolutely clueless, you can pray those prayers and, you know, they are appropriate for that situation. So, any questions or comments about any of that? Yes, Chris?
Have you found any of the prayers in the back of the Book of Common Prayer be helpful?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly not the general Thanksgiving.
Yeah, right.
There's a funny story about an Anglican guy at one point. Yeah. He was so bound up to the Book of Common Prayer that when he got asked to pray at a certain situation, you know, he didn't know how to pray because he was so bound to the prayer book. So he like thumbed through real quick his prayer book and like prayed some totally inappropriate prayer. But I can't remember exactly what the situation was with the prayer, but it was funny. At least it wasn't I heard it. There in the Book of Common Prayer, there the 1662 Book of Common Prayer, sort of the standard, you know, Anglican BCP. I would say probably what's better, though, just in terms of offering more prayers in more situations, would be to use the 1928 English of the American Episcopal Church, the 1928 version. It has a lot more prayers for like other occasional situations and whatnot. And there are prayers like particularly for like spiritually distressed people, sickness, death, bereavement, and so forth. They're very short, but they're very powerful and they're helpful. So yeah, I would just say, and that's all online. There's a website. Just type in Book of Common Prayer. There's a website that has like every prayer book ever written across the whole world, like all on one website. It's really great. So, what's that? The website's like the address is like really lame. So just type in Google Book of Common Prayer. You'll find it. It's like justice.something.something.something, like Eskimo something. Yeah, it's really weird. Yeah, I can't. Yeah. Yep, Norman.
I'm wondering about funerals and burials for either stillborn children or for late term miscarriages, in the sense that if a mother, you know, or a father really wants that child to be, you know, buried, because it seems at certain stages in the medical process, like it's very antiseptic, it's very clean.
Yeah.
And in a sense, you know, that thing, as many doctors would see it, is just sort of whisked away. Do we sign with parents saying, no, please just give us the child's body so that way there can be a proper burial? Or do you follow what their desires are, or are you often, I don't know, follow regular discussions?
Yeah, I mean, I've never experienced in our congregation a miscarriage that was like anywhere before 13 weeks, I think. So there's nothing really to bury. You know, there is, but you know, there, the people that I know as pastors that have done that, it's normally it was a stillborn child. That's, you know, and usually the parents are allowed to hold the baby even, you know, before they do what they do with it. But yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, in our tradition, and I, you know, we would, from our point of view, say that it's very important to bury. There's importance to that. And how to deal with that with the doctors and nurses and so forth. You know, I've never dealt with that, so I'm not really sure what you have to say, or I'm assuming that you'd want to say something ahead of time, and that they may themselves, in that situation, not a miscarriage, but in that situation, no doubt they would probably ask you for some consent or some waive or something on what to do with, you know, the tissue, as they would call it. But yeah, in a stillborn, definitely. With a miscarriage, it depends on how far along and so forth. But, you know, I've never actually done a funeral, a burial for a little baby in that situation. Steve?
Yeah, I've done that. My younger brother had he was like a stillborn child. They knew there was trouble all through the pregnancy.
Yeah.
He lived for a minute or two
okay.
And died. But they named him, buried him, and they always dealt with him and their family as a son.
Okay.
So I think it'll be pretty clear where their part is in that situation. So
yeah.
Just be ready to acknowledge life to the degree they want to acknowledge life.
Yep. Any other questions, comments? So, I encourage you to browse and to read those books and articles. You know, if you have any questions, certainly, you know, ask. But there's a lot of difficult situations that you're going to face, and you know, to be as prepared as possible, obviously, only makes you a more effective pastor. So, well, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Very helpful.